Support for Jim Pease's Talk of Iowa Wildlife call-in program comes from the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation, reminding you that habitat loss is a major threat to Iowa's wildlife. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Wetlands, areas of land whose soil is saturated with moisture, are considered the most biologically diverse of all ecosystems. In Iowa, critters love them. It's Wildlife Day on Talk of Iowa, and Jim Pease, Emeritus Professor at Iowa State, will give us a lesson about the history of wetlands in Iowa, efforts to preserve them, and why they're critical to the likes of otters, mink, beaver, and muskrats. We love our hairy wetland critters, and they need our Iowa wetlands restored and maintained. The muskrat, for example, is a semi-aquatic rodent native to North America, and they need wetlands to survive. By the way, they're not really rats because they're not members of the genus Rattus. Besides the muskrat, we've got other things to learn today about otter, mink, and beaver. Wildlife Day with Jim Pease begins in 5 minutes following news from Iowa Public Radio and National Public Radio. And welcome to Talk of Iowa. It's Wildlife Day on the program with Dr. Jim Pease, Professor Emeritus at Iowa State University, and he joins us in our Iowa Public Radio studio in Ames. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Dennis. How are you today, this cold, wet week?
And I could use, you know, we could use some sunshine.
Yeah, we could. But, you know, this is good for wetlands.
Well, I was going to say. You know, I didn't make the connection there.
Yeah, you know, cold, wet. That's the wetlands like it. They're full right now and are doing very well.
So. And the critters love wetlands.
Well, some of them do. They certainly cold, wet weather is not good for young critters of any kind, but certainly the old ones are well adapted for it. These four critters that we're going to be talking about today—otter, mink, beaver, and muskrat—are all. I would call them sort of poster children for the history of wetlands in Iowa. Iowa is very, very rich in wetlands. We have thousands of miles of streams and rivers, lots and lots of interior rivers, as well as the two major rivers along the east and west coasts of Iowa, if you will.
And I was thinking because of all of our farmland, we would have eliminated a lot of these wetlands, but not the case.
That's right. And that's exactly why these are the poster children, because two of the four species were eliminated from the state of Iowa. Now they're back. Two of them survived, albeit in much reduced numbers. And the wetlands were, in large measure, eliminated from the state. If you want to think of two different kinds of wetlands, now we have what are called riverine wetlands. Those are those sort of backwater areas, the oxbows, the backwater marshes that we see along major rivers in the floodplains of the rivers of the state. And then we have what we call palustrine wetlands. Those are the shallow water wetlands that may or may not have an obvious outlet, a stream flowing out of them. Some of the palustrine wetlands are very temporary. They're only here in the spring after weeks like we're going to have this week with lots of rain. They're there for 2, 3, 4, or 5 weeks maybe, and then they sort of dry up, and the rest of the summer they're dry. But that doesn't mean they're not important, because they're very, very important. In fact, as a sort of a gift to us from the last glaciers that last left Iowa 10, 12,000 years ago, the glaciers left behind, especially in the north central 34, 35 counties of Iowa, but in other places as well, thousands and thousands of these palustrine, these shallow water wetlands. Our ancestors, yours and mine, the Euro-Americans came into Iowa, and they were told, actually by law, the wetland laws of 1849 and 1850 said to them, quote, drain them and make them productive, which is really, in those years, we didn't understand how productive wetlands really were. As you said in your introduction, wetlands are among the most productive areas in the world, and yet we didn't see them that way. If they didn't grow food that humans could use, they therefore weren't productive in a sense. And our ancestors, the Euro-Americans, did exactly what they were told. In fact, depending on whose estimates you take of how many wetlands there were, how many acres of wetlands there were in Iowa from in 1830s and 40s. Those are hard estimates to come by, and compare them to how many there were in the 1970s. You know, 140 years later, we drain somewhere between 90% and 98% of the palustrine wetlands in the state of Iowa. Mm-hmm. Now, it wasn't just for farming; it was certainly for roads, for for towns and cities and everything. In fact, there are lots of places in all three of the universities where we have major structures built on former wetlands that you know, sort of we're here, and we pay for that every time there's a flood comes through. A lot of these places get flooded because they're either in the riverine wetland areas beside the rivers, or they're in some of the palustrine wetland areas. And so we drain them. But the other part of the history is the more modern history. The thing that's happened in the last approximately 25 to 30 years is that people are putting them back. Mm-hmm. Due to programs like the Wetland Reserve Program, which was part of the 1990 Farm Bill, and has been part of every farm bill since. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has what's called a private lands program, and they help people restore wetlands. And there are a variety of other wetland restoration programs out there. And Iowans and other Americans, but Iowans in particular, have really responded to it. And we have restored well over now 100,000 acres of wetlands and adjacent uplands in the last 25, 30 years. So that's, you know, it's a pretty good, pretty amazing thing. The interesting thing about it is that the critters have responded as well. Lots of ducks back, lots of wetland critters back, including the four we want to talk about here. Mm-hmm. So the people have responded, and the critters then respond to the habitat available. Sort of build it or restore it in this case, and they will come.
You know? Yeah, that's right. Well, there's some good news then. I was thinking of the Neil Smith National
Wildlife Refuge. Yeah.
Wildlife Refuge. That's just a big wetland, more or less, isn't
well,
it?
No, it's a big prairie. There are
oh,
some
it's a
wetlands.
Prairie.
Yeah,
okay.
There are some wetlands within that. In fact, it's one of the first refuges in the whole National Wildlife Refuge system that actually was prairie. Most of the refuges that were put into that system for many, many years were, or most of the land that was put into that system in many, many years, for many years, was were wetlands. To try and improve waterfowl and other water critter populations. But that was one of the very first that said, no, prairie's important as an area as well, too, and as a type of ecosystem. And after all, 85% of the state was covered with prairie at one point. It's pretty important as well. But there are wetlands that are part of that. In fact, if you think about wet prairie, those are mm-hmm. a type of palustrine wetland.
Oh, okay.
A lot of the plants that are there, the wetlands may or may not be, you know, temporary. They may sort of persist through the summer. They're really there's sort of a whole range of palustrine and riverine wetlands, and fortunately the critters that we're dealing with, you know, wetlands are important to lots of critters, including reptiles, amphibians in particular, insects, birds. But they're also important to mammals, and these are four of the mammals that they're really critical for: otter, mink, beaver, and muskrat. And,
right. These are our hairy wetlands.
Our hairy critters for the day.
Now, you said that two of these had disappeared and have come back. So which two disappeared for a while?
Well, beaver were actually gone from the state. You know, beaver is one of those amazing critters that you could make. They were extirpated from Iowa and have come back pretty much on their own through the river systems, but they were gone because they were you can make an argument that they were the reason that Europeans came to this country in the first place. It was really the beaver fur trade with Europe that caused the French and the English to come to this country and trade with the Native Americans and the Native the First Nation people across Canada. For the beaver pelts, they would take them back to England take the fur off of them, float that fur in vats of water, and then bring up forms underneath, and they made these beautiful felt hats. Beaver fur hats were the big deal in all through the 1800s. And you can make, I think, a reasonable historical argument that that's one of the reasons, one of the main reasons why Europeans came here was, at least in the 1800s, explored particularly the interior of North America, was for beaver pelts, to increase that trade and have wonderful hats.
Well, anyway, the beavers have come back. That's great, huh?
Yeah, they've done pretty well on their own. They were certainly trapped out of Iowa, virtually gone for many decades in the late 1800s and through the early 1900s, and in the last half century have done very, very well in the state. Now, we think of beaver as this sort of pond critter with a great big dome-shaped house built from small branches and logs of trees that they've cut down. And that's the case if you have beavers that inhabit lake country like you do up in Minnesota and parts of Wisconsin, that sort of thing. But most of the beaver here either live on small streams, and they will create a series of dams to dam up that stream, and most of them do not build these large huts. They instead build bank dens, and will use some sticks to kind of tell you where that entrance is if you look carefully, but not always. And the dens have underwater entrances. You see these oftentimes they get exposed in very, very low water and drought years. You'll sometimes see these entrances exposed that used to be below water, and they then go into the bank and up. They're dug by the beaver themselves, and so then the air, the sort of home living room, if you will, is above the water line in the bank of the river. So they're most of the ones we see in Iowa aren't these huge, for the most part are not these huge dome shaped stick and log houses. They live in the banks along our rivers and streams.
By the way, you say beaver and not beavers, right? Is that
correct?
I was trying to follow. It's different for each of these animals.
Yeah, it is. Okay. I think you could probably get by with it as a singular or plural. The etymology of it, I'm not exactly certain.
But, well, I'm dying to find out what the other animal is. That would be otter. Probably.
That's right. You otter be right.
Oh, man.
Well, you ought to know better, too.
We should probably wait. Oh, man. We should probably wait until after the break to discuss otters.
Well, we can.
Dr. Jim Pease. Wildlife Day, toll-free line 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here is, just for you, Jim, the Busy Beaver song. Okay.
Like me and you. I'm a busy beaver, are you a busy beaver too? I'm a busy, busy, busy beaver, I'm a busy beaver, yes it's true. Busy beavers, we are busy beavers, are you a busy beaver too?
20 minutes past 10. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese with Dr. Jim Pease, Emeritus Professor at Iowa State. And today's topic is hairy wetland critters. And we actually have a joke.
The joke was that song. Boy, just try and get that out of your head the rest of the day. You know?
It's called the Wonder of YouTube, you know?
I see.
Sorry about that.
Yeah,
this is a pretty good joke. Brock from Cedar Falls says, here's a joke for Jim Pease. You can often tell information about the environment by careful observation of nature. For example, cricket chirps and air temperature. You can tell the depth of water a frog is in by listening to its croak. Knee deep. That's a pretty good joke.
Not bad.
Well, anyway, let's move while we have some calls coming in. Let's move on to otters because they're just lovely critters, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. And like all four of these are really well adapted to the water. They all have double layers of fur. The guard hairs are this sort of very shiny, longer hair on top, and that's what we see much of. But underneath that hair is this fine, very fine fur layer. A mink have it, and otters, and beaver and muskrat all have it. And that sort of holds the moisture away from the body, creates air pockets in that fine fur underneath. And it makes all four of them very, very valuable fur bearers. And that's, you know, the reason they were still taken for their fur, because they have this incredibly soft fur underneath and this beautiful sheen to their fur on top.
And, you know, let's move on to muskrats, if we could. My
sure.
cousin used to trap them years ago, and I always felt I never approved of that.
But
well, I don't know. He made some real money doing that. I don't know if people are still trapping those critters.
You know what? Muskrats are still, if you took the total fur take in Iowa and multiplied it by what they get for them, muskrat is still the number one most valuable fur in the state of Iowa.
Wow.
You would think that individually that's not the case, because often you only get, although I did see prices from last month's national auction of $8 to $9 for muskrats, usually they're in the $2 to $3 range. The international fur market, particularly because of China, has driven prices up for all four of these critters. Mm-hmm. And muskrats, thinking of an $8 to $9 muskrat pelt, is pretty amazing. So muskrats are as you mentioned early on, are a rodent, just mm-hmm. as beaver are. And they have...
they're not a rat, though.
No, it's not a rat. They're in the same a group of rodents. That means they both have incisor teeth on the top and the bottom and the front that they use to cut off vegetation. But they're really well adapted to life in the water. They're muskrats are quite a bit smaller. You're talking about a body that's about a foot long and a tail that's about a foot long. And the tail on a muskrat is flattened vertically so that it uses it sort of as a rudder in the water as it steers through the water. They have their back feet in particular are semi-webbed. They have a little bit of webbing on them, so they're good swimmers. They have nostrils that close when they go beneath the water, and special membranes in their eyes so that they can see if the water is clear enough underwater. But they're really quite nearsighted. I remember lots of times as a kid in a canoe in the backwaters of the Mississippi or the Iowa or the Des Moines or the Skunk, sneaking up paddling very slowly and being within 3 feet of a muskrat that was swimming in the water before they saw us, you know, would dive down. And they can stay down for 5 minutes or longer, so it's a great way to escape. But that vertically flattened tail, it's not as flat as the beaver's is. You know, the beaver tail is maybe a foot or so long and might be 8 to 10 inches wide. So it's used to warn with that slap on the water other family members in the area. Both of these critters are very family-oriented. They live in family groups. Muskrats, instead of cutting down trees and taking the bark and small twigs that they would take off of the branches to consume and leaves, muskrats, on the other hand, like more herbaceous vegetation. They'll usually live in more quiet water wetlands. They're not; they will live in rivers, but they live particularly in these palustrine sort of quiet water areas and backwater areas of the river, and cut particularly emergent vegetation, things like cattails and bulrushes. And they'll build their domed houses out of those cattails and bulrushes. There's a platform inside that's above the water level. And during the wintertime, they can instead of storing lots of food, they can literally eat the house, eat themselves out of house and home, if you will, by eating the roots and the vegetation that their home is made of.
Well, that's not so smart.
No, well, you don't have to go far for breakfast. You know, on the other
that's
end.
True. If
you roll over and chew it, you know. It's not so bad.
Well, forgive me. So these muskrat pelts are going to China. What do they use them for?
They use them for because they're so water repellent and so warm. They're used for everything from coats to trim on things like that. They're extremely warm. You may not remember it, but occasionally you may have seen in some places muskrat coats used to be in the U.S. a big fashion item. These are long coats that went, women's coats that went all the way down, and sometimes men's coats that went all the way down. Perhaps some of our listeners have owned one of these, and they're extremely warm, and it takes a lot of pelts to make, muskrat pelts to make a single coat out of that. But they weren't all that uncommon in the earlier part of, in the first half of the 20th century. We're pretty common across the U.S.
Let's go to a couple of calls. 866-780-9100. It's Wildlife Day with Jim Pease in our AIM studio. Let's go to Randy in Iowa County. Good morning, Randy.
Morning. I wanted to like to talk about otters, but, you know, I haven't seen a whole heck of a lot of muskrats in the last 10 years, whether it's a lack of habitat or what. But going back to the otters, aren't they pretty darn hard on fish populations and ponds and some places in the rivers?
Actually, it turns out not. That's a common assumption because they're a predator and they eat a lot of fish, but they tend to, like most predators, they'll take whatever's easiest to catch. The easiest thing to catch are the sort of large, rough fish. So they end up, certainly are going to take some other fish occasionally, and they'll take some turtles, they'll take some frogs, that sort of thing. But primarily they tend to eat carp, buffalo, a lot of these older suckers, that sort of thing, rough fish in rivers. So it turns out research shows that they actually improve the fishery in an area and improve the water quality by eating a lot of these rough fish, particularly carp, that actually tend to rile up the water and create a lot of turbidity and soil in the water, which makes it difficult for other fish, the kinds of fish you may want there, bass and bluegill and crappie and that sort of thing, to exist. So it turns out the research shows certainly they're not immune from taking some game fish, basically they take the rough fish. That's a great question.
Okay.
I got a quick one for you.
Sure.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Right. Thanks.
Thanks for that, Randy. Let's go to John in Waterloo. John, good morning.
Good morning. So carping about the otters and their things.
That's good, John.
yeah, you're talking about palustrine and I just wondered what kind of a word that is, if it's a Latin word, and you know what it means or where it comes from. And second thing was, are you going to speak in Cedar Falls this evening to the Ottoman group?
Yes, I am.
Is that true?
Yeah,
true
I'm going to be talking in Cedar Falls tonight to the Prairie. What's it called? Prairie River Ottoman Society, I think it is. Right.
Uh huh.
Be up
okay.
for that at 7 o'clock, I think. So.
I'm not a member of the group, but I've enjoyed your commentary over the years, and at the First Presbyterian Church, I'll just
that's
just
great.
Say that
Thank
too.
You.
Okay, thanks for the call, John.
But about the palustrine thing,
well, we need to take a break.
The word. Okay,
if you can, Jim, maybe you can answer that after the break. Is that okay?
Sure, that's
that
fine.
Sounds good to me.
Okay,
thank
appreciate
you.
That. We'll take a break, and Jim Pease will be back in 5 minutes after the Environment Report. We continue with Wildlife Day and Talk of Iowa. Dr. Jim Pease, Professor Emeritus at Iowa State. Sorry about this one, Jim.
Candlelights, doing the town and doing it right in the evening. It's pretty pleasing.
Talk of Iowa continues. It's Wildlife Day on the program. I'm Dennis Reese, back with Jim Pease, retired professor at Iowa State, as we are looking today, discussing hairy wetland critters. And Jim, wanted to answer that question about wetlands that came in just before the break.
Yeah, it. I probably could have answered it very quickly because I'm not absolutely certain. It's certainly Latin in origin, and I believe it means something about, and I don't have a computer to look it up on, but I believe it means something about originating on the plains, quiet water sort of on the plains kind of thing. But I'm not exactly sure of the etymology of that particular word, but it applies to these wetlands that we commonly have in north central Iowa, and in some other areas of the state. There are these shallow water wetlands that may or may not have an obvious outlet. In other words, they're not always connected to a stream, and they often, not always, but often dry up by midsummer.
866-780-9100, couple of lines open. Oh, you're going to like this email, Jim.
Okay.
You're going to like this one. This message is from Mrs. Nordmeyer's first grade class in Des Moines. Your grandson, Sam, is in the class. Mrs. Nordmeyer says, "We are listening. We are listening, and Sam has a question."
Okay.
"He would like to know if his grandpa has ever eaten a beaver." The rest of the class would like to know the closest wetlands we can visit. So there's two questions
okay,
for Mrs. Nordmeyer.
I have, as a matter of fact, I've had meat from a beaver, and it's not what I would call my favorite, but it's okay. It's a little on the oily side for me. Not good for my heart as a result. the other question, the closest wetlands, is to say there are different kinds of wetlands. Now, right along the Des Moines River that flows right through the city of Des Moines, there are places where the backwaters of the Des Moines sort of overflow. In fact, Gray's Lake, which is on south of Fleur Drive, on the way to the airport there, and just south of downtown. That originally was, it's been deepened now and manipulated, but it was originally a backwater area, sort of an oxbow of the Des Moines River. So if you look at satellite pictures, you could get on Google Earth right now on your computers and zero in on Des Moines and find some of these backwater areas of the rivers. You can also go to Sailorville Lake, and on the very north end of that lake, again, there are lots of shallow backwater areas that are part of that lake, and those are riverine wetlands. Palustrine wetlands are more common farther north if you go up Interstate 35, but you could go to a number of areas in Boone and Guthrie County that have some palustrine wetlands there as well.
Is that your first question from your grandson?
On the no, air, I get lot, on the air, yes.
Yeah, that's okay. Great. Thank you, Mrs. Nordmeyer.
Yeah, that's great.
Really
great.
Appreciate that.
Sure.
Let's go to Bill, who is calling from the Quad Cities. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Thank you. I live over here in East.
He's cutting out.
He's cutting out. Bill, yeah. You're cutting out.
Maybe I'm sorry.
Try it again here.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right, I live over here in eastern Iowa on a small 20-acre lake. In 2008, I put a flotation dock in the lake. This is about 2.5 miles south of the Wapsipinicon River in North Scott County.
Okay.
And we went out last spring and noticed that the dock was settling on one end. So my son and I, we disassembled a 4x5-foot polyethylene float ladder that was underneath it,
mm-hmm.
and discovered a hole chewed in it about 6 inches in diameter. And what uh-huh. amazed me was the float was entirely packed solid with what I'm going to call mussel shells that were split open and, you know, but there were just, I mean, hundreds of them in this thing.
Wow.
And we've had reports. I've never seen it, but several neighbors of mine have said that they had seen an otter in the lake.
Sure.
The year before, and I just was wondering, I thought perhaps a muskrat would have caused this damage, but as I say, it you could definitely see teeth marks on the polyethylene mm-hmm. float where the hole had been chewed, and then whatever this creature was had just packed this thing solid with mussel shells. I mean, we probably drained 6 or 7 5-gallon buckets of spent shells came out of this thing. I'm kind of curious.
That's amazing, yeah.
And what worried me is I was down there just the other day, and I have a suspicion that my dock is beginning to settle again. So I'm wondering. It was quite a bit of work to get that float out from underneath that.
I'll bet.
Do you have any idea what would have caused this?
Certainly both of them, actually, surprisingly, muskrats, while they are herbivorous or vegetarian in origin, they will occasionally take snails, small crustaceans, the odd frog sort of thing. But otters, on the other hand, certainly eat a fair number of crustaceans, everything from crayfish and snails up through mussels. But fish is certainly their primary. I can't imagine. Usually, we see raccoons as being a much heavier a predator on mussel populations because the mussels are often in very shallow water, and long rivers and raccoons are so prevalent in Iowa. But it's certainly possible that they would have otters would have taken. Well, that's a lot of mussel to stuff the shells in there. Usually, otters will come out of the water in order to eat their prey. River otters will, as opposed to sea otters, which actually float on their back and eat a lot of their prey that they might find. But certainly, they will take mussels. So my guess would be otter, but I can't think of anything else right off that would do that. Mink will take a few as well, but usually smaller mussels. Were these large in size, maybe better than 3 inches in diameter, or were they smaller, 1 to 2 inch in diameter?
They're very large. I would say on average they were the size of your hand. They were 4 to 5 inches in length. You can picture a bladder that's about 4 foot by 5 foot, about a foot thick. The hole chewed in the end of it was probably 6 or 7 inches in diameter. It was down in the bottom corner of the float, which was actually underwater, submerged. And I didn't notice it in the fall at all. I'd been down there in the fall, and it wasn't until the next spring we noticed the thing was settling down. So it must have occurred, either late fall or early spring. And but like I say, it was just packed solid with those things. And
That's unusual. I would guess probably otter in the area. Certainly otters. Otters were reintroduced into Iowa as a part of a three-way trade among states. We ended up shipping out some turkeys to another state, and that state then paid another state to most of the otters, the original otters in Iowa that were released by the Wildlife Diversity Program were came from Louisiana, and so these are river otters from the south. You can tell by their accents, and
Cajun otters.
That's right, Cajun otters. And then they've spread. They've done very, very well in Iowa waters, primarily due to the numbers of rough fish that we have. Have spread to other watersheds other than the ones that they released, and are now actually have been they allow trapping sale of 400 pelts per year from Iowa, and it hasn't affected their population at all. It's quite possible that this was made by an otter. Although I can't imagine them. Why they would stuff them in a cache like that? That's the only thing I'm a little bit confused about. I'm not sure why they would do that. They would usually go to shore and consume their prey and then leave the item there. But perhaps.
Well, Bill, we appreciate the call. We have to move on. We've got some other calls.
Thanks
a lot for the call from the Quad Cities. Let's go to another otter comment and observation from Larry, who is calling from Fontenelle. Hi, Larry. Larry, are you there?
Yeah.
And you're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, it's Fernald.
Oh, all right, sorry.
Oh, Fernald, okay.
Yeah, I used to work for the Conservation Commission at the wildlife exhibit over at Boone.
Oh, great, okay.
And we had otters there that we obtained from, I think it was a guy in Omaha.
Sure.
And one of those got away from us and was down on the river for quite a while. We kept trying to recapture it, but it always outsmarted us. So we actually started a stalking program earlier than the talking about.
Right, yeah. But you need more than one, obviously. Yeah, you inadvertently started the stalking program. That's right. Good for you.
But I have Canada geese.
Uh-huh.
And for several years, there's been three of them, two ganders and a hen. And they just seem to hang out together all the time. Do you suppose there's some kind of a love story going on there that we don't know about or what?
Well, it's not unusual in birds to have a teenager that's not reached full sexual maturity that would be a young from the previous year, possibly 2 years earlier. Usually they are geese and not ganders. They're the females and not the males, however. And they actually help guard the nest occasionally, and it happens in other species as well, but certainly it can happen occasionally in geese, Canada geese populations. So, yeah.
These two are, this has been going on for 5-6 years.
Wow.
I'm sure it's the males because they're larger than the hen, and they just fight something terrible.
Yeah, during
the breeding season.
Huh. There must be competing for a limited resource then, I think.
Yeah. The guy that I used to work for was an officer out in Pottawatomie County, and he said the way they could, when they were doing a goose survey, the way they could tell the difference between the males and the females on the Canada geese was they'd spread some corn out, and if he picked it up, it was a male, and if she picked it up, it was a female.
Ah, I see. That would be an interesting way to tell the difference. So, okay.
Okay, thanks Larry. Appreciate the call. Wildlife Day with Jim Pease. You're on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, 866-780-9100, Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. We haven't talked about mink yet. We've left them out, but I want to go to Tom first, who's been on hold here from Iowa City. Good morning, Tom.
Hey, Dennis, thank you very kindly. Hey, I want to congratulate Jim on such a preponderance of knowledge.
Well, thank you.
It's such a joy to listen to you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Really is. You teach me so much.
Well, good. I appreciate that.
About otters, I had read a long time ago that if you were to get one at a very young age, it could be made into a pet.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that, or is that a fallacy?
That's a fallacy, actually.
It is.
There was a thought that, both mink and otters are members of the mustelid family, the weasels. And they're highly intelligent family. This includes badgers, wolverines, fisher, marten, mink, weasels, ferrets, and
so they're not ready to.
They're highly intelligent, and it turns out that with the exception of ferrets, and our listeners who have ferrets out there may want to dispute me on this, but they are never. They're wild critters. They're never really tame.
Okay.
And if you make them mad, often a ferret, I've had lots of students who've had ferrets, and they find that, they'll occasionally bite them. And, and what I've seen in most of the literature and stories that you come across, even the ones that are raised from young in zoos and like that, you can't trust them entirely. They're not tame in the sense that we think of a dog or a cat being tame.
Oh, really?
They might be accustomed to human handling, but it doesn't mean they're dependable. They're not going to necessarily, be there at your beck and call like a dog in particular. I won't say a cat that would do that, but occasionally cats will do that.
Oh, sure.
No, they don't make good pets in general.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, thanks for your program.
Tom.
I just love it.
Well,
I
good.
Appreciate
Thank
it
you.
So much.
Tom, appreciate the call. We better do minks here before we run out
sure,
of time. So
yeah.
what can you give a tutorial on mink?
Yeah, mink is probably it's certainly an aquatic member of this family. They certainly want to be near water, but they are the one of the most adaptable of these four critters that we're talking about today. They live in upland areas adjacent to water areas, and they will hunt in the uplands as well. So they'll commonly you will occasionally see them in prairie areas, in woodland areas, near streams or ponds or lakes or rivers, but they're hunting for upland critters as well. They'll eat birds. They'll certainly eat. They're a predator. They're a carnivore. Will eat lots of rodents. People who raise chickens will know that occasionally they've had a mink get into their chicken house, and they tend to have this undeserved reputation, Dennis, of being bloodthirsty,
mm-hmm.
and really that's just not true. What they are is they're opportunistic, and you have to think like a predator and think about their natural instincts. Their natural instincts are, I may not get to eat for quite a while. It can be a long time between kills, and so they get into a chicken house, and they might kill a bird there and try and drag it out. You think of a chicken compared to a mink. And a mink is often, the body is, it depends on whether it's male or female. The females are about a third smaller than the males. But the male bodies might be a foot and a half long. And then they've got a tail that is anywhere from 6 to 10 inches long, 6 to 8 inches long as well. And so they're taking on a chicken. It can be quite a large bird, and no problem at all. They're pretty fearless, yeah. And then they've got all these others lined up here. They come in at night. They're hunting nocturnally. Maybe originally came in because of mice in the walls or something like that, or rats. And here are these chickens sitting on this roost, and they kill one. And gee, that wasn't very hard. So the instinct kicks in and says, "I have to kill when I get a chance." And so they might kill four or five or six. And people say, "Well, they're bloodthirsty. They're wasting." No, they're not. They're just simply reacting like most predators do in an unnatural situation. Here are all these birds kind of lined up on a roost. It's pretty simple. So it's just their instinct kicking in, and it's not because they're bloodthirsty. It's because they're opportunistic.
So. Think like a predator. Sounds like the name of a rock star, but I don't know. We'll go next to John. John is calling from Rhodes. Now, he has a comment regarding Sam, your grandson's question. So we'll see what that comment is. John, good morning.
Good morning. You hear me?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. I was just going to suggest that probably the nearest wetland to Des Moines would be Engeldinger Marsh.
Sure. Yeah. That's
I would also suggest that within a couple of miles, that is the Chautauqua wetland area.
Good suggestion.
And, they can make a field trip and see both riverine and glacier pothole
and
type
cluster.
Wetland.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Yeah, I'd forgotten about Chautauqua. That's a great riverine wetland. Exactly. It's part of the Polk County Conservation Board land in that area as well. So.
Well, I was going to suggest that any trip like they should be coordinated through them. They could probably help interpret what they're seeing and everything.
You bet. I have lots of interpreters down there. Lots of them are former students of mine. So a great bunch of people with Polk County Conservation and would help them coordinate that. Great suggestion. Thank you for bringing that up, John.
Appreciate the call, John. Let's go next to Bob in Firth, Nebraska. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I do want to echo one of the previous callers. I've lived all over the country, New York to Frisco, and you fellows have one of the finest public radio stations, and I've echoed that to Professor Schmidt. I'm blown away. I love you guys.
Thank you.
I'll be real quick. Over here, one of the cleaner bodies of water, small Wildwood Lake vicinity of Valparaiso, Nebraska, Natural Resources District. I was doing some gentle stream clearance for sweepers, coordinating. And while canoeing, the very small upper estuary, small established wetlands, saw a little creature. I didn't want to stress him out, so I didn't follow too closely, but he was about 8 to 10 inches long, reddish, silky fur with a little silver stripes running down, and I thought, maybe an otter?
I think probably a little small for an otter, probably a mink. Mink will swim very well. They have partially webbed back feet in particular. They're quite good swimmers, very commonly, from the size alone, I would say probably mink. Otters tend to be much larger. The body of an otter without the tail is, 24 to 30 inches long, and particularly big males. And the tail adds another 12 to 14, 15 inches. So
I initially guessed mink, but in Saunders County, Nebraska?
Oh yeah, yeah. They're amazingly wow. adaptable little buggers.
Wow. They,
yeah, yeah. They're. I have found them literally in the middle of a city. I found a dead one on a road, right in the middle of campus. One day, got hit probably during the night, and yeah. So it they will venture quite a ways away from a stream, away from a permanent wet area, and hunt in the uplands as well. So yeah,
I'd
be surprised.
So, he'll be my little buddy when I'm canoeing there.
All right, that's great. Oh, and thank you for cleaning out the sweepers. Sweepers are those trees and branches that fall into rivers. And having been caught in one, I'm particularly appreciative of those who clean them out. So that's great.
And when they're last point, when they're elm, they're tough to cut through.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Let's try to get one more caller in. This is Mike from Forest City. Good morning, Mike. You have a quick question?
Yes, I do. I have a small water garden about 25 feet long, mm-hmm. and we've been noticing we have just we host quite a number of these grackles.
Sure.
And they come flying in like dive bombers, and they release this white mm-hmm. material.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I know where you're going with this. This is actually, these are fecal sacs. Grackles are sort of colonial nesters, and they have groups of nests in an area. And instead of dropping the feces right over the side of the nest on the ground, they're sort of like diapers, if you will, and they carry that away from the nest and often drop them over the water. So that predators cannot track their way back to the nest, and they're very good parents as a result. And those of you who have ponds and streams want to keep them clean, it's difficult this time of year because the grackles are carrying these fecal sacs away from the nest area.
Well, fecal sacs is not a great way to end the program, but I guess we're going to have to end it with that. We are out of time.
Well, I just say to for folks to, despite the wet weather that seems nasty, think of the wetland critters, the wetlands that's filling up, and get out there and visit some of those local wetlands, be they along rivers and streams or the palustrine wetlands in the flatter areas as well.
Thank you, Jim Pease. We're going out with Touch of Mink, Doris Day from the 1952 movie. Thought you'd appreciate that. Talk of Iowa production assistance today is Christoph Meyer. By the way, thanks, Jim. Talk to you in a month. And Talk of Iowa, a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dennis Reese. Thanks for listening. It's
broken by a bear of silence.